All right. I think if I've done my homework correctly, on the line should be Sonny Osborne. Sonny, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Man, you sound good. You sound really strong. You got a great connection today, and everything's working well.
I sound young. I sound really young, don't I?
I didn't say that, but yeah, okay, I'll go for young. You do sound young. On the phone, you could be 40.
See, I haven't been on 30 seconds. You've got to lie already.
That's that prosecutor thing. I mean, although, you know, that's been 30-something years, but it hangs around. It hangs around.
No, I'm doing okay.
You sound good.
I'm okay. Interesting thing happen, though, it was 3 or 4 days ago. We were at a softball game, and I was sitting behind a fence down the right field line. And like a fool, I wasn't paying attention, and a ball was hit, and I didn't know it was coming. My wife was sitting beside me, never told me anything, and I accused her of trying to push me in front of it, but she said she didn't. And anyway, that ball hit me right on the left jawbone.
Oh, geez.
If you put your thumb on the point of your chin and move your index finger up toward your left ear, about 2.5 inches, that's where it hit. Right on that bone, and it's a wonder it didn't break the bone, but it didn't.
Every time I talk to you, somebody's kind of whittling away parts of you somehow.
I know it.
You've been hit by cars. Bill Evans shoved you down to stomp over you to get to lunch.
I don't know, man. I'm leading a weird existence right now.
I thought your wife was a softball player.
Oh, she is. She knew I was going to get hit, and she pushed me in front of the ball.
She's supposed to catch it, I thought.
She's supposed to push me out of the way because I'm her livelihood. You know? No, that's not the way it happened.
All right.
That was a lie, too.
Oh, man. Well, listen, I haven't, I guess I've seen you a couple times this year already, but in the meantime, happened was that latest, I want to talk about Nashville, the last one of that Pinecastle release a little. I've already played 3 tunes from it today.
Oh, okay.
And we'll talk about anything you want to talk about, but I want to talk about that last Nashville. It's called Nashville, the last one. I guess like a 4-part series on Pinecastle, right?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you how that came about. We were in the middle of an album for MCA, and they informed us that we were going to have to be produced by a guy named Suthy Miller, who played the drums in Bill Anderson's band. And we had produced ourselves for the last 8 years, I guess. And so they told me that, and I just told them, I said, no, we produce ourselves, and I don't need anybody else. They said, well, you're going to have to take Snuffy Miller. And I said, no, we're not going to have to take Snuffy Miller. And we argued back and forth a little while, and I just told them, I said, well, Snuffy Miller doesn't know what we do. He has no idea. And I said, we produce ourselves. And they just refused. And I said, well, I'll tell you what you do then. You give us a written release from MCA, and we're out of here. That'll be the end of it. Because we're not going to let Snuffy Miller produce a record of ours. And so I think Bobby happened to mention that we should buy the masters that we already had cut. And so as part of the deal, we got to buy the masters that we had, which was 7 songs at the time. And we got those masters and just kept them. Bobby kept them for about 10 years at his house. And then I asked him to let me have them, and I would take them and mix them and get them ready to put out if we ever did want to put them out. And so as time went on, I got the songs, and Steve Chandler and I mixed them at Hilltop Studios in Madison, Tennessee. And we just hung on to them for the longest time, and finally we sold everything we had to Pinecastle Records.
Mm-hmm.
And that included those seven masters. And then we had started doing a four-part set of albums for Pinecastle. It was Dayton to Knoxville, and Knoxville to Detroit, Detroit to Wheeling, and then it was supposed to be, the last one was supposed to be just Wheeling to Nashville, mm-hmm. or the Grand Ole Opry, whichever.
Okay.
But we got three done, and then we just kind of ran out of steam, and I really wanted to retire anyway, and which I did. And then I got a call from Ethan Burkhart at Pinecastle, and he wanted to release those masters. And I said, well, let me have them mastered at a place here in Nashville. Well, actually, this in Tennessee, by John Eberly, Americana Music Incorporated. And so we did that, and I don't know if you know the process or not, but you record the things, and then you remix. You overdub it, you have to. Then you remix it in the studio, and then you have it mastered, and then they put it out. Well, the remix is pretty good, but then when you have it mastered, then they put the, they make it, instead of a rough edge, they put the velvet touch to it when an album is mastered.
Okay.
And so we got all that done, and he was going to use a picture of Bobby and I on the cover, but he said it was too grainy. And it was weird about that, too, because one of the best photographers in Nashville had taken that shot in the 60s, or 70s, I guess it was. And that would have matched what the time period for those songs.
Yeah.
And he said it was too grainy, and I said, well, whatever you want to do. It wasn't up to us anyway. So he titled it Nashville. And those songs were recorded in 1974. And then I got to remembering one thing, that when we did the Ernest Tubb album for Pinecastle, there was one song that we didn't use, and I actually don't know why. I can't give you a reason why we didn't use it. But it's called Half a Mind, the old Roger Miller song that Ernest Tubb did, had a hit on. And we had recorded that song, and for some reason we didn't use it. The sound wasn't exactly right on it somehow. I don't know why that is. But anyway, I reminded Ethan Burkhart that they had that song, and it belonged to Pinecastle to begin with, so why not use it too? And that would empty the suitcase then of everything that we had that had not been released.
Yeah.
And they did that. So there's eight songs on that thing. And I like the sound of it, but I don't know how it's going to mesh with what they're playing today. It is really old-time bluegrass sounding. And what they're calling bluegrass now doesn't match that.
Well,
I do
understand, and we've had this discussion before, you and I, many times, just even sitting around, not just on the air, but you know, even for recording this in 70, there's some kind of some, and you always were sort of advanced or progressive sounding on tones and things, licks that you played on the banjo. There's some drums. I mean, this isn't 1959. I mean, it's the early 70s, and you're saying now, looking back, it sounds real traditional, but it's kind of progressive for the 70s, don't you think?
Well, I think at the time, I don't know how to put that. At the time, it was as progressive as one can get, I think.
Yeah.
Because we'd already been through the electric instruments and amps and drums and all that stuff. And we had gone back to playing just traditional bluegrass because I thought we had run that gambit already.
Yeah.
And it was time just to go back to our roots because I didn't, at that time, I didn't think that we were really a long ways from retirement, or I wasn't anyway.
In the 70s?
Yeah. I was really, by 1974, 75, we worked ourselves completely to death. And by then, I was really getting almost sick of it. And I've told you many times, in 78, I got that Granada banjo, and that changed the whole thing around. It was fun to play that banjo.
Oh, you're right.
And I stayed with it and stayed with it too long, actually, I guess. And I thought about probably in the late 80s or early 90s sometime, I really thought our music started deteriorating to the point to where it just didn't sound real good anymore.
Well, in what sense? In the choice of songs or the playing or the singing or what?
The songs, we didn't have anything new. And I didn't want to put out the energy, and Bobby didn't put out, did not put out the energy to find anything new. And our rehearsal time was on stage in front of people, which we had always done that before, but we were 25 years older, and it takes more. The older you get, the harder you have to work to maintain as far as playing an instrument and singing and all that. And I just thought we got sloppy with our music,
okay,
to be honest with you.
Okay.
And I don't know, it kept, we had Terry Eldridge and Terry Smith and Gene Wooten, and that helped immensely. And David Crow, I'm sorry, I forgot David. And with those guys, that helped a whole lot. And through the 90s, that's what kept it going through the 90s, because they were all just excellent players and good guys along with it. And it was kind of fun to do again. And but by the end of the 90s, I was just completely burnt out, totally. And I guess I had shoulder surgery in 2003, and that stopped my banjo playing completely. I haven't played the banjo since 2003. And I sang with them for a little while longer than that, and I just quit. I didn't want to do it anymore, and I quit. I just stopped.
The shoulder surgery was rotator cuff, and what I remember from that, Sonny, because
yeah,
I knew you before,
yeah,
and after that, is that it was that you couldn't reach as easily out the neck as you wanted to.
No, I could go up the neck, but there was a muscle in my shoulder that was gone that would let me go back down. And I couldn't, it was just impossible. I couldn't. Had I been 35 years old, I would have willed myself to play.
Yeah.
But I wasn't 35, and so I really didn't miss it, and I haven't missed it 1 minute. And that is strange, too, but because it's been my life. It was my whole life.
Do you think that you don't miss it for a couple of reasons? Number one, you're still involved and I know that you work behind the scenes. People don't know how much you do for musicians locally in Nashville and how much contact you have and advice. You're still sort of in that business and from as a mentor position, don't you think?
Well, yeah, I guess I have the banjo camp, and then I also have a banjo company.
Right.
As such. And but really, that's about all. And I have a lot of friends, Larry Stevenson and Bill Evans and Cindy, and I just have a lot of friends. I mean, let's face it, that's all I've known my whole lifetime.
Yeah.
And I mean, 50 years of your life is a long time. And I still see them occasionally, and you, and, you know, people like that. But as far as missing playing the music and getting prepared to go somewhere and play, no, I have not missed that one minute.
You know,
and every time I think about it, it almost makes me sick. Because it was the last few years was really hard. Really, it was a job. It was not fun anymore. It was a job. And when your work becomes a job, I mean, they're hard to do, then you should get out of it.
I think, anyway. The Osborne brothers, Sonny, the Osborne brothers hit it so hard and so dedicated for so long that when you talk about a band that had been together for so long at that high level, I mean, I think what you're saying is kind of to be expected. I mean, you when the Osborne brothers hit the stage, they were ready. That, you know, you had that ability to really turn it on stage, but also you were ready to go. You weren't just showing up to show up. It was a band that was the one that you heard and saw for all those years, and you did it at such a high level for so long. So I mean, so thinking that you might be tired of it, I think that's kind of a natural response, really.
Well. It was like, it was a business. I mean, you know, and we always tried to dress like we were going to work. That was our office. The stage was our office. And, it got hard to watch these people coming up who looked like they slept under a bridge all night. And I just don't like to see that. I didn't like to see that. And what they do is none of my business. I know that. But my business is my business. And it inside me, it just grates on my nerves that guys are doing that. Country players do that too. And it just really bothers me. I don't know of anybody that wears a suit and tie at the Grand Ole Opry anymore.
Really?
But then, of course, I don't go to the Grand Ole Opry anymore. So I wouldn't know.
You know,
but I mean, there's got to be some respect somewhere for what you're doing and for your people sitting out there watching you. They don't need to see dirty blue jeans and shirts ragged and hanging out and holes in the knees of your jeans. They don't need. I don't think they need to see that. But then, you know, that's just me. So.
And then
you know what? The last probably year and a half or 2 years, we always kept our bus in Gallatin, and I would go to Gallatin and get the bus and bring it back to Hendersonville, and we would load up and leave from Hendersonville, and it got to the point that when I would turn into the driveway where that bus was sitting in Gallatin, I would almost get sick to my stomach enough to actually throw up. It really, I just got so sick of it. You cannot believe it. You just can't believe. And it sounds like that I'm putting it down or all like that, but I'm not. Boy, it gave me a wonderful living. It sent my kids through college, and you know, it was my life. And I was successful at what I did.
Boy, were you.
I thought. And,
gosh.
But there comes a time in your life when you know that it's over. And I knew it was over. I talked to Bobby about it. We were in Lexington. They were going to put it in front of this theater in Lexington. They were going to put a plaque in the sidewalk with our name on it, and we were sitting out there waiting for them to make the presentation, and I told Bobby, I said, you know what, right now, while we're at the top of the game, we ought to get out of it, just walk away from it, and we've done all we were supposed to do, and we did it as well as we could, and he said, well, not me, I'm going to stay as long as I can, and I said, well, I'm just not going to do that. And so, I think it was 2004 or 5, I just finally quit completely. And I wish he would have too, but he didn't.
Well, in 2004 or 5, you were still singing, but like you said, you weren't playing anymore because of that rotator cuff.
It's either late 4 or early 5 that I stopped completely. And then I had that brush with a stroke in 2007.
That's right.
And by then, though, I was completely done with it already. So there you have it.
You know, you made this comment before, just to back up a little bit about the appearance on stage, that you always felt, and maybe it's because of the time that you came into the business, I think we talked about this as it relates to the Ryman and performing at the Ryman and the Grand Ole, the old Grand Ole Opry. You felt like people came into the show to see a show. They didn't want to see themselves on stage, and we're talking about appearance. But you felt like you were giving the audience a show, that you were showing up to, you know, maybe they knew they were there to see something special if you came out and were dressed appropriately.
Well, I always thought that when we came on stage, our guys they weren't matching and have uniforms on,
no.
But they used to do that years ago, but they kind of got out of that because I think the reason that they did get out of it is because, like when you saw Ernest Tubb or Carl Smith's band or Jimmy Dickens' band, they all had uniforms that matched. Ray Price's group, they all had uniforms that matched. Well, the leader of the band had to furnish those uniforms. And there was a guy in California named, I think it was Nudie, that made those suits, and they were not cheap.
No.
They were expensive. And I think that the band leaders really got tired of doing that. I mean, these were like $200 or $300 a piece at that time. And we're talking in the 60s.
Yeah.
And at that time, and those guys had, like Ray Price had 10 or 11 guys work for him, and Ernest Tubb had 5 or 6, and it got expensive. And I think that the band leaders really they didn't want to do that anymore, but they insisted that the guys at least dress. And that's, we did the same thing. Our guys dressed alike, up and I don't remember when the last, but they still had, well, we wore ties and jackets on stage. And I always felt like that the guys sitting out there in the audience saw you come on and you were dressed like that. And it looked like that you had dressed because you respected what you were doing and respected them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way I felt about it. It might be wrong. I don't know. But that's the way I felt about it. Anyway, and nowadays it's not like that. These guys go on, they look like, just like I said, look like they slipped under a bridge all night. Which is good if that's the way you want to do it. That's fine, but I just never saw it that way.
Yeah. Hey, who on the Nashville album, on the cuts that you put on this album, who's with the band back in that time?
That was Dale Sledd sang with us and played guitar, and I think Robbie played drums, I think, on that. And Dennis Digby played the electric bass on that stuff that we did in 74.
Mm-hmm.
Robbie is Bobby's son, by the way.
Sure, okay.
Without doubt, the greatest bluegrass drummer that ever lived. He was excellent. He really was good. And then we also had Hal Rugg playing steel, and Grady Martin playing electric guitar, and Leon Rhodes played electric guitar on some of them, and Pig Hargis Robbins played piano. And I believe that, oh yeah, and Bastard Clements played fiddle.
Man.
On some of that stuff. I'm not sure he was on all of it, but I think he was. But he played fiddle on it, Pastor Clemens did.
Well, when you just mentioned the people that are on the album, that's why I mentioned that it's a progressive sound for the 70s bluegrass. I mean, you put all those people in there, it's a little different, you know.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. But we had been doing that with those guys, we almost would not go in the studio without those guys. That was called the A-Team back mm-hmm. then. And they recorded with almost everybody in Nashville, and we insisted on having them. And Owen Bradley had been producing us to that point, and that's when they tried to change. And Owen let us do our own work. He told one guy, he said, I don't know what they're doing, and nobody else does. And he said, they know what they're doing a lot more than we do, and they're successful, so why not let them just go ahead and do what they've been doing?
Yeah, really. Makes
and
sense.
We were producing ourselves all through the Decca and MCA time up until that point. And then I don't know what kind of deals Snuffy Smith or Snuffy Miller had with MCA. I have no idea. I never did want to know neither. But he never produced anything that we did.
Sonny, let me ask you this so we don't assume too much when people are listening to this. When you say produced yourself, what do you mean by producing yourself?
When you have a producer, he sits a lot of times in the control room, but I didn't. I played on the stuff, and I would have headphones on, and I would get the steel or drums or whomever would do something that I didn't think sounded right or was a little out of tune or timing was bad or something like that. The producer is the guy that says, wait, whoa, stop. You need to retune the bass or you're doing a bad lick on this one part of this thing. It needs to be changed in order to smooth it out. That's what a producer does.
Okay. And then
he oversees the sound is what he does.
And then you're also involved, and I guess because of that position, you're also involved in the final mixing, I guess.
Oh, yeah. And see, in the early days, they didn't tell us. MGM nor Decca didn't tell us until 1966 or somewhere right along in there that we were even allowed in the studio when they mixed. And we didn't realize that was our stuff, and we were paying for it, and we had a right to be right in the middle of it if we wanted to be. But we didn't know that because they didn't tell us that. And when we got into the mixing part of it and all like that, why, we learned a whole lot about making records and how they're supposed to be made. And it was kind of fun for a while, but it's kind of long hours and hard work. And I'll bet you I spent 2,000 hours in the studio all during that time, especially with CMH and with Pinecastle.
Wow.
It's rewarding when you get done with it. You can sit back and listen. You say, that sounds good. That sounds the way I think we ought to sound.
I know you spent a lot of time on the thing from Germany that came out as a DVD, and because I know I've talked to you about that in the past, where you kind of got into the modern, cutting little pieces here and there to fix up the sound. You know what I'm talking about on the... So you got not only the old time mixer, but you're into the new stuff where you can steal parts and move it around
a little bit. A little bit.
Yeah.
I was into it enough to where that I grew weary of it after a while because it gets old.
Okay.
We did one album. It's supposed to be live from Germany.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah, talk about that just for a second.
And the guy recorded it illegally to begin with. And he was in Germany, and when we came back here, we didn't even know it had been recorded. And I think Streakermoor, Germany, is where that was, in the northern part of Germany, which I love Germany, by the way. I really like Germany. France is another whole different ballgame. Anyway,
that's why there's no Osborne Brothers live from France, I guess.
I just had to throw that in.
Okay.
Lest someone forget about my true feelings toward France.
Okay.
Anyway, this guy nobody was supposed to record that. Well, we got back we came back home and was working, you know, and I don't know, I guess it was a year later that Tom Riggs, who owned Pine Castle Records, called me one day and he said, there's a guy from Spreakermoor, Germany, had recorded you while you were there, and he has that whole show on tape, and he wants to sell it to me, and if I don't want to buy it, he's going to give it to Bear Family. And we didn't play that good on that whole thing over there. We did not play that well. And I asked Tom how much the guy wanted. I don't really remember. It seemed like it was $10,000, but I can't remember exactly. And I told Tom, I told him the situation. I said, well, if you don't buy it, he'll give it to Bear Family, and they'll reduce it just as it is. And so he bought it. Long story short, he bought it. They didn't have a machine to play it on because the format is different in Europe than it is here. And he had to find a machine, and they finally found one in Pennsylvania, I think. And so when we got it back, it had a little blip. By that, I mean just a little noise, like about every 15 or 20 seconds. And come to find out that that tape had a code in it that it rechecked itself about every 20 seconds, and you could hear that. And so we had to go through that. John Everly from Americana Mastering figured out a way. No, I'm sorry. We contacted that guy, and he had given us a copy, and he had the original. And so he and Tom got together, and I guess Tom called him a few choice names and threatened to do anything, and the guy finally sent the original, which was clean. And John and I worked 2 years on that show to get it, and I didn't keep track of the hours. It was a lot of time though, and we worked on that for 2 years. I don't talk in every day. We would do something, then you'd take it and listen to it and say, no, that's not right. We'd have to go back and redo that. And Glenn Duncan helped so much on that because Glenn's a genius musician. And then I got the bass and the guitar was not very loud and clear on that tape. And I mean, this thing was made with a home recorder, just to record it. And anyway, I got Charlie Cushman and Terry Smith to come in and redo the guitar. Not redo it, just put it on there. And oh, incidentally, this thing was on stereo, but each individual instrument was not mic'd or tracked. That's what they call it.
Oh, okay.
And so we couldn't overdub anything. We just had to add to it and hope it worked out. And so Charlie Cushman put guitar on the whole thing. And then Terry Smith came in to show you what a genius Terry Smith is. He came in and put bass on that, which he had played bass on it to begin with, but it wasn't very loud. But he played bass on that thing and went from one tune to another and never missed a note. And he actually played over himself and did... Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm.
He played over himself and played note for note and never missed a note.
That's amazing.
And Terry Smith is a genius. He's the best bass player in this town at this time.
So he played over himself, and you weren't knocking out the original bass because you couldn't, but he was able to play note for note.
Yeah, he played over himself. And if he had hit a wrong note or wrong time, why, you could hear it. You could have heard it.
Wow.
As a double note. And so you play that and listen to it, it's right on the money. He is the best in this town, and it's a shame he doesn't get the recognition that he deserves.
Wow.
But anyway.
Okay.
Well,
interesting.
There was one place in a song called Sweethearts Again. that on the first, no, on the second chorus, my voice broke. And it was just terrible. It was, oh my gosh. And so John said, you know, John Everly, he said, you know what I could do? I can take your voice or take from the first chorus and put it there. And I said, really? He said, yeah, we'll try it. And you listen to it, you can't tell it. You can't tell one thing where it stops and starts. I mean, it's just perfect. But we did things like that on Wreck of Old 97. Bobby's mandolin was out of tune on it, and it was flat enough that we couldn't use it the way it was. And so what we did was the crowd noise, I think we took it and made a track of the crowd noise, and as soon as Bach started playing, we put this crowd noise in there, and it kind of blocked the mess with that.
Crowd noise. I never thought of that one.
He goes, da, 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 and that crowd just goes straight. and it kind of just blocked the rest of it out. And it was, made it passable.
I'm good.
It worked. And there was another thing, a song called Nearer My God to Thee, that Steve Thomas was playing fiddle with us, and he'd only been with us a short time. And he wasn't used to what we were doing, so at one place, on Near My God to Thee, when we get down to the last chorus, we come to a stop and go down from, like, okay, from a G, and we go down to a D. And then we end it by singing in D in a different type of harmony. Steve forgot. And when we went to D, he stayed in G. And he's just going along like that, and he's in, and it just ruined it. It totaled it. And Glenn Duncan, I called Glenn and told him the situation, and I said, I really would like to use this. Do you think there's anything you can do? And he said, well, let me think about it. And he said, yeah, let's go to the studio. And he said, you know, in every key that you change to, it has some notes that belong in other keys. Now, if you can follow this,
okay,
you're a genius. And I
can hear the words that you're saying, let's put it that way.
I said, like, if you're in G and go to D, that D chord has somewhere in that scale, it's got a couple of notes that match G. I can't describe it any better to you. So anyway, Glenn went in, and where Steve Thomas stayed in G, he took and played three parts on the fiddle. it just sounds like it's meant to be that way.
Really?
And he saved it completely. And you listen at it, and it's there. I mean, you know, and it turned out as well as it could. I'll put it that way. And we had a decent live show out of it. And that's one thing that we just never could do, was record a live show that really sounded good. Because we played with our music too much. I mean, to have a really good live show, I mean, we had fun with it. And if I wanted to do a screwy sounding lick anywhere, I'd do it. I mean, you know, it was entertainment. And that's what our job was, entertainment. It wasn't go up there and try to be perfect. It was entertainment.
Well, you guys had fun. And you had fun on stage.
We had a heck of a good time on stage. We laughed at each other and laughed with each other. And there was one time in Wheeling, West Virginia, we were on stage playing, and this place was full, you know. And in the back, they had glass doors up. The doors in the back of the auditorium had glass in them. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so I'm on the stage up there, and we're playing, and I saw this guy back there, and he had a hat on, and he kept moving around, and I kept looking at that guy back there in the back, and we went on with the show, maybe four or five songs into the show, and I got to thinking, boy, that guy's handler's just like Bobby's. And we kept on playing, and I thought, it is Bobby. And it was a reflection. It was a reflection, man. And I was looking at him. I told Bobby earlier, I mean, right while we were playing, he was taking a break, and I said, there's a guy back there in the back that's got exactly the same hat that you've got on. And he looked back there, and he said, MPA. And, you know, when you're in the midst of a show like that, you just don't think. And when I realized what it was, I just started laughing. I thought, how stupid that is of me to even think that somebody would be back on the back moving just exactly alike. And it, and then I told the crowd, and they had them. They laughed.
Oh, my.
It was funny.
So wasn't there a guy that looked just like you standing next to him?
Well, I didn't pay attention to that. I was looking at Bobby. I recognized Bobby's hat. And
sure.
I thought, I think I've got a hat exactly like Bobby. Funny. Yeah, we had a good time. We really did. I don't know if you want to talk about anything else, but I'll tell you another story. But we played in Lebanon, Virginia one time at a festival. And we're on stage, and you got to picture this. From the stage forward, a hill went up. And, I mean, this is right out in the country at a farm. And a hill went up, and the crowd was sitting on that hill. And it was a natural amphitheater, if you know what it is, you understand what I mean.
Sure.
And so we started singing. We started singing Kentucky, Kentucky. You are the dude. And all of a sudden, over this hill, there appears like 10 cattle. I mean, just cows out in the pasture. They just walked up over that hill when we started singing Kentucky. And we all, everybody up there, we just couldn't say it. We just started laughing. Because of cows, it was like they just came up to hear Kentucky. And there was a bull in the group. I think you figure where I'm going with this.
Was he wearing Bobby's hat?
No.
Okay.
No. And we were, everybody on the stage, we were just laughing. I mean, just laughing, and we couldn't go on, so we just stopped. And I told the crowd, I said, when we sang that Second Life of Kentucky, those cattle back there came right up over that hill. And the whole crowd turned around and looked at those cattle. Well, just at that precise moment, that bull decided that he was going to do his job right there. And he did. I tell you, and the people, I swear, it was like 15 minutes and people were still laughing, and we were too. It was a funny
oh,
thing.
Well, that's great. I mean, those are, like you said, you had a good time on stage.
Yeah, we did.
That was fun.
We had a good time with our audience, too. And we make fun of them. They make fun of us.
Yeah. Well, some of them dressed just like you, too.
Oh, that's funny. There was a guy at Myrtle Beach, too, that he sat about the third row, and I always sat, my place on the stage was Bobby's in the middle, and I'm to his right.
Right.
And the guitar player was to his left, and then David Crowe was to my right. Well, there was this guy sitting on about the third or fourth row back, and honest to goodness, he just sat and had the one look on his face the whole time. And he wasn't smiling. He never applauded. He didn't laugh. He'd tell anything funny. He didn't laugh and didn't do anything. He just sat there. And so, I mean, this went on for like 5 years. Every time we'd play Myrtle Beach.
5 years? Did you say five years? Okay.
Yeah. About probably longer than that.
Okay.
But this guy was sitting out there. So the second or third year, we named him Mr. Good Time. And so about that, I guess maybe the third year, I walked over to David Crow and I said, David, there's that guy sitting right in front of you out there. He's about three or four rows back. I said, he doesn't move. He doesn't do anything. And when we got through, he wouldn't applaud. He didn't stand up. He didn't do anything. And so we nicknamed him Mr. Good Time. David came over to me about that fourth year over there, and I guess Good Time had smiled or something. And David said, "Chief, look," he said, "Good Time must be having a hell of a time. Look at him."
Did you ever go down and ask him?
No, I didn't want to go near him.
Okay.
And but he did. He smiled at one time. David called. But that's the only time I ever saw him make any kind of facial expression or anything. I think he always sat with his mother and this guy had to be over 30 years old. Unreal.
Unreal.
We had a good time, though.
You did. You did. Time. I appreciate you. And, you know, every time we talk to you, more of those things come back because, you know, how could you get them all in? But those are great stories. Those are great. I like the new. Is there anything else in the vault? I mean, now that Nashville's out, you say, is there anything else in the vault yet to come out?
That's all of it.
I think I have about 600 songs in my library that I pull from on this show. I don't play them all, but I mean, so I think I have most of everything that's out there that I can get my hands on. So now I've got Nashville, too.
I need to count up how many songs we've recorded.
Well, there's a bunch of them. I may have some repeats because, you know, they show up on different collections. But as I look at my account, my library here, it's like 560 or something like that. So,
wow.
That ain't bad. That ain't bad.
That's a lot of songs.
That's a lot of songs, man. It's a lot of songs.
Yeah.
All right, listen, man, I'm gonna let you go. If I don't get out of here on time, they slam the door on me. So,
All right.
We will do this again. I'll come down and see you sometime this summer. I had a flood of trips to Nashville there for like a month and a half, but I don't have any set for a while, but I'll come down someday.
I appreciate talking to you. You're a good man, and thanks, I enjoy
son.
Talking to you. Great deal.
I appreciate that very much, Sonny. We'll talk again soon, friend.
Take care, buddy.
All right, see you, bye.
Bye.
It's always fun to talk to Sonny. Every time we talk, there's something different that comes up, because how can you remember 50 years on the road and 50 years in the studio? And every time he tells a new story, I thought, well, I've never heard that one before. I had never heard either one of those. And I spend pretty much time just hanging out with him when I'm down there. And they're always different stories. And you always think, I got to remember that one. Well, you can't. There's too many of them. So we started out talking about the new album, Nashville, which comes out on the street Tuesday. And that's where we go. We start out on a topic and then we go wherever. So Sonny Osborne is just a dear friend. And I would do anything for the man. I'm just telling you that right now. So.